After having prepared all of that machinery for quantum field theory in curved space-time, now we apply it. We apply it to cosmology. And you will see it's much faster now that we don't have to go through all the details or the proofs. And we have a highly symmetric special case, but in principle, it's the same strategy. We go to the Lagrangian formulation with the action, pick up what the canonically conjugate momentum is, and then we quantize. In the process, we will encounter something that I could have mentioned earlier, but it might have been confusing. So it comes up today. And that's the question of what is energy. You might think, I've heard of this before. I know what energy is. It's the Hamiltonian. What you will find is that for the same system, you can have a lot of Hamiltonians, infinitely many, to be precise. So that would indicate naively that the energy is not unique. But it's not so. In general relativity, energy is defined differently. See, pre-general relativity, the energy is synonymous to the Hamiltonian, and it's the generator of evolution in time. That's ultimately what the Schrödinger equation says. It says that, you know, ih bar dt psi is h hat psi, and that's to say that this thing is generating time evolution, right? Because if you exponentiate that operator, you get a finite translation in time. And that's the same as exponentiating this one. And that gives you the unit time evolution operator. So energy is, in pre-general relativistic times, defined as the generator of translation in time, the Hamiltonian. But in general relativity, that's not so. In general relativity is a completely different definition. Energy is what gravitates. Energy is what curves space-time. Energy is the zero-zero component of the energy-momentum tensor. And there's just one energy-momentum tensor. So we will find that the energy-momentum tensor is unique. The Lagrangian and the action are unique. But you can have any number of Hamiltonians you want. And there is a canonical one, but the others are just as good for generating time evolution, as we will see. And in fact, we will choose a non-standard one because that's actually more convenient. Okay, but we will come to these considerations at the end of the lecture. First, let's do quantum field theory on Friedmann, Roberts, and Walker space-time. Why FRW space-time? Here's a picture of the universe, and it looks relatively inhomogeneous. There seems to be more matter here than over there, for example. But actually, the observation is that if you zoom out and you look at the universe at length scales of about a billion light years or longer, we can only see like dozens of light years far, but at about 1 billion light years, the distribution of matter is really extremely uniform in the universe. And therefore, it is a pretty good approximation to assume that we get away with the description of the universe as being spatially very flat. So that will be our first approximation. Later, we will introduce inhomogeneities and wrinkles into the space-time. But let's start out with describing the universe as spatially extremely flat, but only spatially. Right? Remember that curvature, the curvature tensor is a 4x4, I mean, it's a 4x4x4x4 matrix. And it mixes space and time. There is the traditional intuitive space-space curvature, but there's also space and time curvature, curvature between the space and time directions. You know what that is? It's expansion or shrinkage. And so that we still allow, but spatially we assume it to be flat, the space-time. And that implies also that the, or that what we assume is that spatial flatness is not only a feature of today, but was also, that it also was very flat and in the future will be very flat. This is actually not a trivial assumption. It turns out that you can find exact solutions to the Einstein equations for cosmologies that are other than the Friedmann, Roberts, and Walker spacetimes. You just loosen the assumptions of symmetries, and often you get away with still being able to solve it even with less symmetry. And as was pointed out, as you can read up on, for example, in the book by Wainwright and Ellis, Wainwright was the chair of our applied math department when I was hired. Wainwright and Ellis, in their review book on exact solutions of general relativity, review this fact, for example, that there are solutions to the Einstein equations, cosmological solutions, which at a point in time are as close to spatially flat as you want. But before and after, they diverge from that, and they become very non-flat, exact solutions. So we shouldn't just go by the assumption, oh, now it looks flat, it has always been flat. No, no, we are doing the assumption here that it has always been flat, will be flat, and there's only curvature between space and time, so there's only expansion or shrinkage. Now, with these assumptions, let us now choose convenient coordinates. Let us start by choosing a time coordinate. Now, when we look at faraway galaxies, not nearby galaxies, but faraway galaxies, we find that they move away from us. And the further they are away, the faster they move away from us. You know, that's the Hubble flow. And it's not that they actually move away from us. It's just that space is continually being created between us and them. Not true for nearby galaxies. I mean, yes, the space is being created, but nearby galaxies don't have to move away from us. For example, we are on a collision course with our neighbor Andromeda. But overall, on large scales, the universe is dominated by the Hubble flow. And we will define a coordinate system that grows with the Hubble flow. So for example, we could pick time now and then choose a coordinate system, and then where a meter is a meter, and then we let the coordinate system grow with the universe. But what about the time variable? Well, the rate at which time passes depends on your state of motion. And now assume clocks distributed throughout the universe that have no other motion than the Hubble flow. Galaxies are an approximation to that, but not really a very good approximation to that. These velocities that deviate from the Hubble flow are called peculiar velocities. Does anybody know how fast we are against the Hubble flow? I looked it up, 625 kilometers a second. But it depends on the season, right? Because we are going around the sun at about 25 kilometers a second. And so sometimes you add that, sometimes you subtract it. Right? It's so relative to the overall direction we go in. So about 600 odd kilometers per second. That's our peculiar velocity.
Of the
Earth. Or let's say the solar system. Okay. And what that means is that the cosmic microwave background in one direction looks bluer, in the opposite direction looks redder. That's essentially why we know so exactly, why we know so precisely. Anyway, so what we will do is we will choose the time coordinate to be the wristwatch time of a freely floating astronaut who has the engine switched off and is not having any peculiar velocity. So it's moving with the Hubble flow without peculiar velocity. That is the cosmic time that we're going to use, at least for a little while. And that's the cosmic time according to which the universe is 13.8 billion years old. Because obviously, you could be orbiting a black hole like an interstellar, or you could be traveling really fast, and then the universe would be much younger for you. So we use the proper time as the time coordinate, as cosmic time, we use the proper time of a freely falling observer who has no peculiar velocity, who is observing the cosmic microwave background, for example, at the same temperature. I mean, there's no overall blue or red shift in any particular direction. Now, what space coordinate should we use? Well, there we have to be clever and do what I just indicated a little earlier. We choose a time, and that could be our time now. And then in our on paper, what we do is we fill the universe with rods and clocks. The clocks are having cosmic time. And the rods are, let's say, 1 meter long. But then as the universe further expands, we let the coordinate system expand with it. And that has an important effect, multiple important effects. In the particle picture, the effect that it has is that the coordinates of a galaxy stay the same over time. Even though the galaxies drift away from another, the location, at least of a galaxy that doesn't have peculiar velocity, its coordinates are going to stay the same. Because as, let's say you have two galaxies, as they drift apart because of the Hubble flow, because of the expansion of the universe, well, the coordinate system drifts apart the same way, right? And so it's still numerically the same coordinates. In the wave picture, and that will be more important for us, it means that the wavelength stays constant. You take a laser pointer, you make some light, and it will have a certain wavelength. In co-moving coordinates, that wavelength will always be of the same numerical value, or the momentum will always be the same numerical value, even though the actual physical wavelength, of course, stretches as the space underneath expands. So to our eyes, the light will redshift over time, or as you go back in time, will blue shift. But by having this so-called co-moving coordinate system, we absorb all of that. And the wavelengths will stay numerically the same. And that also means that the momentum stays numerically the same. That's very important, because if you remember what we did in Minkowski space, we did the Fourier transform for a particular purpose. That wasn't just for fun. We did that in order to decouple the harmonic oscillators. Remember that in Minkowski space, we said that at every location in space, there's a harmonic oscillator. And these harmonic oscillators are coupled to each other through the derivative, the spatial derivative terms. So we have coupled harmonic oscillators, which accounts for the fact that if you tickle a field here, then the excitation will spread. That's because of those derivative terms. But then we said, well, that's a mess. We have so uncountably infinitely many coupled harmonic oscillators. How nice it would be if we had individual harmonic oscillators that are not coupled. So we did the Fourier transform. The space derivatives became multiplication with the momentum variable, and we had independent harmonic oscillators. That's why we do the co-moving coordinate system now, because the wavelengths are going to stay the same. And so if you create a laser beam, for example, of a certain wavelength, its wavelength is going to stay the same, the numerical one in this coordinate system, even though it will redshift. And what that means is that in that coordinate system, that harmonic oscillator doesn't hand over its excitations to any other harmonic oscillators. If we didn't do this, what would happen? Can be physically expected. Namely, we start, let's say, with a blue light laser, and then over time, the blue light will cease to exist, and green light will exist, and then the green light will cease to exist, and red light will exist, which means the blue light harmonic oscillators will get de-excited, the green ones will get excited, will get de-excited, the red one gets get excited, and so on, in a continuous fashion, of course. And that's what we don't want. Right? That would mean that after the Fourier transform, what we should expect is that in the Klein-Gordon equation, after Fourier transform, we still have derivatives in there, in the equation of motion, which means that the momentum harmonic oscillators are coupled. By choosing the co-moving coordinate system, we avoid that. The harmonic oscillators will still, just like in Minkowski space, the harmonic oscillators will be decoupled. we just have to keep in mind that at every point in time, one of those harmonic oscillators means something different in physical momentum, in physical wavelength. It's just in this coordinate system that the wavelength stays the same. So then, how should we expect the metric to look in this coordinate system where we have cosmic time and the co-moving spatial coordinate system? Remember that the metric always takes this form. So the line element squared, so the small invariant distances squared can always be written as the metric tensor and then these small space-time distances. Now in our coordinate system, the metric tensor must take, therefore, this form. Why? Well, why do we have a 1 here? Well, because as far as time is concerned, it's actually the wristwatch time of an observer that is just going with the Hubble flow. It's, for example, just sitting there at a fixed coordinate, and then lets time pass. And you know, such an observer who just goes with the Hubble flow only has a fixed position. The position doesn't change. It's like one of those galaxies that always have the same coordinates if they don't have a peculiar velocity. So times are just measured in this way. But what a coordinate distance means in co-moving coordinates depends on time. At the present moment, when we define the coordinate system, where a unit 1 is actually a physical meter, there we have that this A, the so-called scale factor A, is just 1. And we have that these physical distances are the same as the co-moving distances. But later on, for example, two galaxies that are later on much further apart, numerically still have the same delta x's. But the actual physical distance has grown. That's accounted for by these factors A in here. I mean, one A for each of these dx's, so that's why we get the A squared. And we're making no assumption here, not yet anyway, about what that function A of t is. We expect, of course, that we have an expansion of the universe, but whether it's accelerating or decelerating, or in which way it does that, we are not making any assumptions about that. It could all be described by these functions A of t. So this scale factor does the following, as we just discussed. Imagine you have two galaxies that are apart by a spatial distance of delta x1, delta x2, delta x3. So these are two Hubble flow galaxies that don't have peculiar velocities. Then I don't have to specify at what time this was the distance between them, because we're using a co-moving coordinate system. The distance is always the same. They always have the same numerical coordinates. But what distance that actually is depends on time. So if we pick a time, then we can calculate the invariant distance as the square root of that expression here with the metric. And because we have this a squared here, there's an a squared in here, which we can pull out, and then we have the a in front. So at the present day, when a of t is 1, this is just the usual distance, but in a billion years, these galaxies will be further away from another. The numerical distance in co-moving coordinates will still be the same, the numerical differences, coordinate differences. But here we're interested in the scalar, in the actual invariant distance, which doesn't depend on any choice of coordinate system, of course. And that's why we get this factor of A here as well. Matthias?
I have a question. I don't know if this fits, if the question fits now, but so I know that the proper distance is going to be the distance that all observers are going to agree about. But when we say this galaxy, when we make a statement about the distance between stars, between galaxies, right? Is it a statement about the proper distance or a coordinate distance? What's the distance that we really measure when we make a statement about, like,
But
this galaxy is like 50 light years from Earth.
No, that's right. It depends on the path and principle, right? You could have two events and you ask, what is the invariant distance between them? Well, a generic definition would be to use a geodesic distance, for example, between them, right? But actually, I wrote here deltas, and they are meant to be small ones because that's what the metric gives us. The metric gives us the infinitesimal distance, right? So if you have infinitesimally distant coordinates, then what is the invariant distance? You calculate that way. And then, if you want to know what is the distance between faraway events, you have to integrate these distances up along the path. And the path is your choice. Yeah. It could be geodesic or not geodesic. That's your choice.
Yes, but my question was more about how people doing in cosmology when observational cosmology.
Maybe what we need to distinguish here is this. When we say that the distance is invariant, what it means is that it's invariant under the choice of coordinates in which you calculate it. It doesn't mean that the distance is invariant independently of how you define the distance, right? For finite distances, you either choose the geodesic or you go a few loopings before you go there. All of that will change the invariant distance of that path. And is therefore, in that sense, observer or choice of trajectory dependent. But still, even in those cases, it never matters in which coordinate system you measure that. And the term invariant distance refers to that diffeomorphism invariance, that it is a scalar. It doesn't matter in which coordinate system you calculate it. But the distance does depend on how you define the trip from one to the other. Okay, so notice that space and time are being treated here quite differently, right? We choose the cosmic time, we get a 1. And then we choose Kolmogorov coordinates, we get an a squared here. But we're kind of used to the fact that space and time are treated differently from another. But we will find it useful later on to simplify that situation. And for that purpose, we will move away from using the cosmic time and use a different time. But before we do that, let's see, what about this scale factor a of t? What should it be, and how is it determined? Well, what that scale factor is depends on all of the equations of motion. You see, in principle, of course, the metric could be way more complicated. And in nature, it is, of course, more complicated. But it's dominated by these contributions. And in order to calculate what the a of t is, we need to solve the Einstein equation and all of the equations of motion of all the matter, at least the equations of motion of the matter that contributes most to the energy momentum tensor, that contributes most to gravity. So what we need to solve simultaneously is the equations of motion for all the fields, let's call them phi I, and the Einstein equation. So this would be Maxwell equations, Dirac equations, Klein-Gordon equations, and all of that. And on top of that, the Einstein equation. And nobody knows how to solve these equations altogether. Even without gravity, we can't solve the equations of motion altogether. We can't solve, even classically, without gravity, the Maxwell equations and QCD and the weak interaction and so on altogether. And putting gravity to it, which is highly nonlinear, because look at how the metric enters into here, right? The metric enters into the curvature tensor. It's also here and there again. And then the metric also appears in here, in the energy momentum tensor, right? So it's all over the place. The whole thing is highly nonlinear. It's not the case that if one g mu is a solution and another g mu is a solution, the sum of the two is a solution. It doesn't work that way. So in particular, we will, at least for now, make an important approximation, the so-called semi-classical approximation, where for now, for the next few lectures, we will aim to quantize only the matter fields. And remember, for cosmologists, light is matter. Everything that's not gravity is called matter. It's just as opposed to gravity, right? So we quantize only the matter fields, and we assume that we know the metric. Or at the very least, we treat it as classical. And that allows us to write down the left-hand side of the Einstein equation without quantizing. We're just saying, OK, just the metric. And that's a classical function, and so is the curvature tensor, and so on. But on the right-hand side, we have the energy-momentum tensor, which is an expression in all of the fields, because all the fields contribute to the energy-momentum tensor. And therefore, this team you knew has a hat. But that's not compatible to have here classical stuff on the left and quantum stuff on the right. Therefore, we do what comes first to mind, but it may not be all that great, which is that we say, well, the quantum fields have to be in some state. Let's call it omega. And we work in a Heisenberg picture. And we say that, OK, we just take the expectation value of the energy momentum tensor. Energy momentum tensor has quantum fields in it, after all. But once we take the expectation value, this becomes number value, no longer operator values, and therefore compatible with the Einstein equation there. Now you might say, OK, it's a low order approximation. We are not taking into account the true quantum nature of the energy momentum tensor. But I think it's worth keeping in mind that there is something fundamentally shaky about this, which is that the Einstein equation is local. So everything happens at x. So the metric and its derivatives at a point equal to the energy momentum tensor at a point. But you see, energy and momentum, if we learned anything from non-relativistic quantum mechanics, energy and momentum cannot be localized. Right? If you know the momentum, you don't know where you are. And the same with the energy. But here we're doing just that. We're taking the energy momentum tensor, take expectation values, and hoppla, we get the function of energy and momentum as a function of space and time, as if we could know both where and what energy and momentum. So let's keep that in mind. But you know, it is actually a good approximation, but we need to keep in mind always now, if things get strange, we should worry about this. Are we still in the regime where this makes sense? OK, so our ambition for now is that we will try to quantize the matter fields, at least the Klein-Gordon field. And we will assume that the scale factor function A of t is given, which is to say that we will assume that the space-time itself is given. So in the lowest order approximation, we assume that the quantum fields and their fluctuations are not substantially acting back on the space-time, are not substantially affecting the evolution, whether it is going to expand in an accelerated or decelerated fashion and so on. We just assume it to be given, the time evolution of space-time. That's a steep assumption here, because what other than matter could cause the universe to do the behavior that it does? You know, we know that the universe had a lot of acceleration, then not so much acceleration, and now it's accelerating again. That's not just gravity alone. Matter does that. So fundamentally, we cannot get away with this forever. We cannot simply say that space-time does its thing and doesn't care about the matter on it, and the matter just goes on a ride. No. But our first approximation for the next few lectures will be just that. We assume that for reasons that we will study later, the space-time is undergoing a certain expansion expressed by a scalar function A of t, or a number-valued function A of t. And we find out how a quantum field, a scalar quantum field, behaves on that background. Yeah?
So in
in this making this approximation, you're looking at the dynamics of the expectation of the energy momentum tensor.
Yeah.
But after, so it's still like, so it's not really quantum dynamics, right? You're already...
No, no, at that point we are throwing away quantumness when we take the expectation value. For reasons of needing to make it compatible with that equation. Because if there are operators on the right, there need to be operators on the left, but how do we do that? No? Okay. All right. So we've just nicely set things up with the cosmic time and the co-moving coordinates. And now I come along with another time. So remember how far we got. We described the metric in this way with our assumptions of cosmic time and co-moving coordinate system. This is how the metric looks. I mean, plus the assumption of isotropy and translation invariance, homogeneity. But wouldn't it be nice if the metric could perhaps be put into this form? Now, if we could actually write the metric everywhere, at all times in this form, well, then we would be dealing with Minkowski space. So we can't, for sure, get away with finding a coordinate system in which the metric is this, because otherwise we would just still have Minkowski space. But what we can hope for is that we might find a coordinate system in which we have an a squared here as well. And if we do in that coordinate system, then we can pull an a squared in front of it. Then we have a squared times eta. And that will prove very useful to have. What that would mean if we achieve this is that we discover that FRW spacetimes, these spacetimes, are conformally equivalent to Minkowski space, meaning same metric up to a scalar prefactor function. And indeed, that can be achieved. We can change the time variable, and in general relativity, we can always change any kinds of variables, such that we get an a squared over here. How can we do that? Well, this one is multiplied in distance calculations with a delta t squared, right? Delta t squared, this multiplies delta x1 squared, multiplies delta x2 squared, and so on. So this term is a delta t squared. And we want it to be a squared times the delta eta squared, where eta is the new time variable. Right? So we want to replace the time variable t by a new time variable eta, such that a delta t squared, or a 1 times delta t squared, is an a squared times delta eta squared. So what that means is, you know, the delta could be made arbitrarily small. And we can take the square root of this. And then we see that this means that delta t has to be a delta eta, or dt is a d eta. Or if we write it as a differential equation, it means that d eta by dt is 1 over a, which we can integrate up. It depends, of course, what that integral is. Depends, of course, on what a of t is. So depending on what the spacetime does, whether it expands exponentially or polynomially or whatever, we get a different antiderivative here. But no matter what the antiderivative is, we can always make that definition. We can always define the new time variable eta, which will be called the conformal time, as a function of the old time variable t, as the outcome of that integral. It's called the conformal time because its existence highlights that the metric can be put into this form, because now the one, instead of the 1, we have an a squared here, so we can pull an a squared in front of the metric. The metric we can write down as an a squared multiplied by the Minkowski space metric. So the existence of that coordinate eta highlights that FRW space times are conformally equivalent to Minkowski space times. By the way, we now have two occurrences of the letter eta that have nothing to do with another, right? Because we have the new conformal time variable eta, but we also use the Greek letter eta for the Minkowski metric. But that should not be, I don't think anybody will mix that up. Okay, and what does it mean for the inverse of the metric? Remember that the metric with the upper indices is the inverse matrix. Well, if the one with the lower indices has an a squared, then because the one with the upper indices is the inverse, it has a 1 over a squared prefactor. Right, when I say that this is the inverse matrix to that one, what I mean is that if you write the metric with the two upper indices and the metric with the two lower indices, and sum over nu here, then you get the Kronecker delta. So it's literally, in the sense of linear algebra, the inverse matrix. So now, this factor that is normally difficult to calculate for generic curved spacetimes is easy to calculate in these coordinates for FRW spacetimes. Namely, what we need to calculate is the determinant of the metric with lower indices, take the absolute value, and then the square root. Well, let's see. We have to take the determinant of the metric. The metric is this one. So it has an a squared here, there, there, there. So it's a to the 8th power with a minus sign in front. That's the determinant. But we have to take the absolute value of that determinant. So that gives us an a to the 8th power. And then we take the square root of that. That gives us a to the 4th power. With this, we can now write down the action. Remember, we don't want to jump right into the Hamiltonian formalism, because first we need to know what is the canonically conjugate field, conjugate to phi. So for that, we do what we did in the completely general case before. We start with the action. So the Klein-Gordon action always takes this form, no matter what space-time it is. Cosmology or not, always takes that form. But now we have a specific expression for the metric, namely this one, and for its inverse, we have that. So let's plug this stuff in. So the g with the upper indices gives us a 1 over a squared times the Minkowski metric. And here we have it, 1 over a squared times the Minkowski metric. And here we have the derivatives. Remember that these commas mean derivatives with respect to d by dx alpha. So that's what we have here. And then that doesn't change. The square root of the absolute value of the determinant of the metric with lower indices, we just calculated, and it's a to the fourth. So that's the action under the assumption of isotropy, homogeneity, that is to say, Friedmann-Robertson-Walker space-time. And from that, we can then use the Euler-Lagrange equations to calculate what the equation of motion is, to calculate the Klein-Gordon equation on a FRW space-time. By the way, everybody says FRW space-time, but there should also be an L. Because actually, it was L, which is the name of a fellow by the name of Lemaître, exactly. He was apparently the first to point out that GR really forces a Big Bang. So he didn't coin the term Big Bang. I think that was Wheeler. But the idea of a Big Bang, I think that goes back to Lemaître. So this is the general Euler-Lagrange equation that always holds no matter what the space-time is. But now we know what the square root of g's are, etc. So we can plug all of that in there. In fact, we can do it two ways. We can plug our g into the Klein-Gordon equation, the general Klein-Gordon equation, and get the special Klein-Gordon equation for FRW L space-time. Or we can apply the Euler-Lagrange equation. We can functionally differentiate directly that action here. Either way, what we get is this expression here. And let's go through it a little carefully, because something very, very, very important happens between here and there. So here is the Euler-Lagrange equation in general, the general Klein-Gordon equation on a generic curved space-time. But we have a special case where 1 over square root of g is 1 over a to the 4th, right? Square root of g, a to the 4th. So it's this term. And then here we have that first derivative. And if we were on Minkowski space, things would be super simple, because that would be 1. This would be just the eta mu nu, and that would be 1. And what we get here is just the sum of the second derivatives, the usual D'Alembertian, right? It would be d by dx naught squared, because this is diagonal in Minkowski space. And then we would have d by dx1 squared, d by dx2 squared, d by dx3 squared, and with a minus sign between the time and the space derivatives. So we would get the, this is just the D'Alembertian, right? It's also the D'Alembertian in general, but it's much more complicated in general. But I just want to remind you that these two derivatives are there, and normally they just combine to becoming second derivatives. But in a generic curved space-time, this stuff is going to be space and time dependent. And therefore, what we should expect is something very important. What we should expect is that this derivative, by the product rule, will produce two terms. One term where it acts on this and differentiates that. Then we get another function here and a first derivative. That gives us a first derivative term, which is new. Minkowski space, the D'Alembertian only has a first derivative. And then a term, of course, where this is not differentiated, but instead this one helps that one in differentiating whatever is written afterwards, like the phi. So the important thing here is that curvature produces first derivatives in the Klein-Gordon equation. And here's how that happens. So we have the 1 over a to the 4th term from the 1 over square root of g. And then we have here the metric that gives us an a squared eta mu nu. Remember, that's by design. And then here we have that derivative. And now it happens what we were just discussing, namely this derivative here sometimes combines with that one to just give us a second derivative. But it can also get hung up here by the product rule and differentiate that with respect to time. You see, in FRW, Lemaitre space-times, there's only a time dependence, no space dependence in this, which means that as far as the space derivatives are concerned, they always pull through. But the time derivative produces an extra term. And that's what we get. What we get is that we carry this forward, and then we have a term where this derivative simply sails through that and differentiates here. That's that term. So we're just carrying this forward over here. But by the Leibniz rule, by the product rule, there's also a term where d by dx naught actually gets hung up on that time-dependent a. And then we get a 2a a prime. So we get 2a a prime divided by 1 over a to the 4th. And then only one time derivative here. So that's the first derivative term. And then the m squared term just carries forward. So now let's reorder all of that stuff. What do we get? In particular, what we get is that the term that there are terms that are just like the regular Laplacian, the space derivatives, right? Because for the space derivatives, things are very simple. And so what we do is we collect these, we write this as a term for the space derivatives. And then there's a term with the second time derivatives. And we take the entire equation and multiply it with a squared. And when we do that, this is the result. So for example, remember we multiply that entire equation with a squared. So this becomes 1 over a squared. But there's another a squared. So the a factors go away here. And then we have a term with eta naught naught. Gives us the second time derivative of phi. That's this term. And then there's the space derivatives. They acquire a minus sign because now the mu and the nu are I. They are between 1 and 3. And that term will give us this term here. You see, we did 1 over a squared, but we multiply the entire equation by a squared. So it's just a regular Laplacian. And then we carry forward the m squared term. Since we multiply the entire equation by a squared, it's an m squared a squared term. And we have this term, the new one, the term that has a first derivative in it. And that term takes this form here. You see, we have a divided by a to the fourth. That's 1 over a to the third. We multiply the entire equation by a squared. That's a 1 over a. So we have here 2 a prime over a, phi prime. So if this term was absent, what would we have? We would have an equation of motion that looks extremely similar to that of Minkowski space. Second derivative in time minus some of the second derivatives in space plus a squared m squared phi equal to 0. What we would get is simply a theory that is identical to the one in Minkowski space, except that the mass would be time dependent. That's what it would be. But we do have that term, and so that messes up the interpretation. In fact, what does a first derivative term do when you have an equation with second derivatives being proportional to, second derivatives being proportional to the field itself?
Diffusion or dissipation?
Yeah, that's right. It's like a friction term, friction or anti-friction. So that's what we have. We have here second time derivative plus something something first time derivative plus something. The field is equal to 0. It's a friction-like term. Now remember, what we want to do is definitely reduce the quantum field to an assembly of independent harmonic oscillators. As we will see, it was very helpful that we use the co-moving coordinates. We will see that soon, because that will help us decouple the harmonic oscillators. But now we face a new problem. They're no longer harmonic, because they have this friction law, anti-friction type terms in there. So we'll have to pull another trick out of our sleeves to free our harmonic oscillators, because we know how to solve clean harmonic oscillators without friction terms. In fact, it's a little fishy to do it with friction terms, because in principle it always means that you would have to have something to sink energy into, take it out of, which would mean, strictly speaking, that you have an open system and then it might decohere. Doesn't happen here, because the culprit is not another quantum system. The culprit is space-time, right? Space-time can either take energy out of a field or pump energy into the field. It's parametric driving, right? So that doesn't have to decohere. Just like in any quantum theory, if you have just classical parameters changing the Hamiltonian, then you can change the energy. It's like an open system, but it doesn't behave like a quantum open system. So that's the situation, and what we have to do now is we have to transform that into some kind of momentum space. Of course, it's going to be the co-moving momentum space. And then we will also have to take care of this friction term. We don't want that. We want to change variables in some way to get rid of that term. And let's do that first. Let's try to get rid of that friction type term by choosing clever coordinates. And the way we do that is to say, what's the friction doing? I want to undo what the friction does, right? Now, the friction would, depending on whether it's friction or anti-friction, and that depends on whether we have expansion or shrinkage, what it does is it depresses or amplifies the amplitude of our harmonic oscillator. So if we just let these things happen, don't interfere, then the oscillations would die down or the oscillations would grow in amplitude, right? But what we want is a description in which the amplitude stays the same. So what we do is we preempt this shrinkage or the expansion of the amplitude by defining a new field variable, which is simply scaling with that amplitude. And the simplest possible answer actually succeeds. We simply scale the field phi with the scale factor A of eta.
Does this mean that anytime you have parametric coupling, you get a first order derivative like this? Is this like independent of the...
Yeah, you see that whenever you have space and time dependencies here, space or time, I mean, it could be just space dependencies too, right? Whenever you have that, then you get a first derivative term. It's not always first derivative in time, right?
It'd be spatial, right?
Yeah, but you could have a space dependence that creates a first derivative in time term because the metric has no reason to be diagonal. So it's really generic. Okay, so we make the simplest possible ansatz, and it will succeed. So we say, okay, because of the scale factor, that's the only thing that, the only degree of freedom that gravity has in this simple model, the amplitudes will grow or shrink. Let's just say it's described by A. So we multiply our field with the scale factor and give that new field a name, namely chi of eta and x. So this field chi still depends on the conformal time and the co-moving location. It's the amplitude now for which we have a redefinition. And of course, it's still the exact same theory. Because if we calculate chi, we can easily recover what phi is just by dividing the chi by A. So let's do it. Let's transform what we have here into the new field variable. Instead of phi, we use chi. Let's see if we succeed. What do we have then? Well, what is phi prime then? I should say, when we differentiate with respect to the conformal time, when we differentiate with respect to eta, the symbol to use is a prime. If we differentiate with respect to cosmic time, then it's a dot on top. That's a very generally accepted convention, right? So a time derivative with respect to cosmic time is a phi dot, but conformal time is a phi prime. I should have said that when we introduced the conformal time. OK, so let's say we want to calculate now. I see this is all derivatives with respect to conformal time here. So let's say we want to calculate that. Well, let's see. Phi is 1 over a times chi. So d by d eta of 1 over a times chi gives us, by the product rule, a term where we differentiate 1 over a. That gives us a minus a prime over a squared times chi. And a term where we do not change the 1 over a, but we differentiate the chi. So we get a 1 over a chi prime. If, on the other hand, we take our field phi and we calculate a spatial derivative, so this is d by dxi, that's also with a comma here. There's never a dot. So phi comma I, that's the derivative of, you know, phi is equal to chi over a. It's a derivative, space derivative of that. But that doesn't really change because the 1 over a of eta is only time dependent, not space dependent. So as far as the space derivative is concerned, we don't really get any new terms. OK, so now we can express the time and the space derivatives of phi in terms of the new variable chi. And we can plug that in here, and we can plug it into there, and so on. Let's do this. And when we do that, when we plug these into, let me show you up here, into the action. Here's the action, the Klein-Gordon action for an FRWL spacetime. When we plug this phi prime and this phi comma I into here, then what we obtain is this expression. Now we have the Klein-Gordon action expressed in terms of chi and its space and time derivatives. Chi prime is the time derivative with respect to conformal time, and that's the space derivatives with respect to the co-moving positions. And what we now have is that in this formulation, the theory has no longer any a squared factors here. It just has the second time derivatives, just has the second space derivatives, just like Minkowski space, except for a time-dependent mass. That's what we boiled it down to, a time-dependent mass. And we can already see at this point that we are going to succeed when we now do the Fourier transform from the co-moving positions to the co-moving momenta. And the reason is that the space derivatives here, which couple the neighboring harmonic oscillators to each other, the local harmonic oscillators, these space derivatives under the Fourier transform from conformal positions to conformal momentum, just an ordinary Fourier transform, will become ordinary multiplications with the conformal momenta, and therefore no more derivatives there. And therefore we get independent harmonic oscillators, except that these harmonic oscillators are going to have as their back driving force, this term here, something time dependent. That's what we were anticipating, namely that gravity is parametrically driving fields such as the Klein-Gordon field. By the way, I leave it to you as an exercise to show that when you plug these two into the expression for the action up here, that you actually get the promised expression here. Now, when I looked through my lecture notes last night, just to remind myself of these things, I thought, I don't see it. Why? How does this work? Because, you know, there's a second derivative in here, and there isn't in there. And so you wonder, see, there's no second derivative of A in there, but it's down there. You wonder, how does it actually work? And I very much recommend that you do the calculation yourself. Because what you will find is, yes, it works out, but only up to a total time derivative. So there is a time derivative term that we then neglect under the assumption that it won't contribute at the boundary. One day this sort of thing might be important, so I'm just pointing it out. See, because usually you read this somewhere and people will just, you know, shove it under the rug. But that sort of thing may be important, like when you consider the beginning of the universe or something. Okay. All right, so this is what we arrived at. The action is now expressed in conformal time, co-moving coordinates, and with a time-dependent mass. Now, what would be the equation of motion that we then get? Well, the equation of motion is calculated from the action through the action principle, least action principle. So we take ds by d phi equal to 0. Well, that would be in the terms of the old variable phi. But now we can also do that with respect to s, with respect to chi, ds by d chi equal to 0. Or is that right? Is that really equivalent? Do we get away with this? And the answer is yes. The answer is yes, because if we require that ds by d phi is equal to 0, well, ds by d phi can also be expressed as ds by d chi by d phi. And d chi by d phi is easy to calculate, right? It's just a scale factor. And if this is vanishing, that is vanishing. If that's vanishing, then this is vanishing. This is non-zero. So therefore, yes, it's equivalent to extremize with respect to phi or with respect to chi. So we may as well calculate the equations of motion directly in terms of chi. We've just completely switched over now to conformal time, to co-moving coordinates, and to the chi variable field. And what we then get for the equation of motion, we can very easily read off from that action here. We get the usual equation of motion, where the mass term now is this one. So it's just the Klein-Gordon equation. And if A was a constant, let's say 1, then, like, you know, remember, by convention, we set the scale factor equal to 1 at the present day. Then this term goes away, and we just get m squared here, and we have the ordinary Klein-Gordon equation. All of the impact of the parametric driving of gravity is now absorbed in the fact that there's an a squared term and a minus a double prime over a term. And there's a huge amount of physics in that minus sign. Super important, that minus sign. Can you guess why that might be?
You reach, if this term goes to 0?
Yeah, it could go to 0. What would that do?
Massless.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, it's not the end of the world if the Klein-Gordon field has no mass. Right? Then what would be the frequency? And you would have some k squared. Instead of the frequency omega being k squared plus m squared, right? You see, normally we have that omega k, the frequency of the harmonic oscillator, is the square root of k vector squared plus m squared. And now we get the same thing, except that this m is time dependent. It's all of this, right? All of this plays the role of a mass. I mean, it enters, like, it's not a mass, but it enters as if. So this could go to 0, but then it could go further. Yeah, exactly. That could happen. Right? What could happen is that the sign actually flips of this whole thing. And therefore, that this thing goes negative. And so much so that the entire discriminant goes negative. And that means that omega, the frequency, becomes imaginary. And what that means is, just like Sepehr was anticipating, that instead of having a harmonic oscillator with this potential, well, now we have a harmonic oscillator with that potential. And instead of harmonic oscillator solutions that are oscillatory with the frequency omega, no, then we have harmonic oscillator solutions that, yes, go exponential, but no longer with an imaginary exponent, but with a real exponent. Right? So the particle in that harmonic oscillator, or whatever the degree of freedom is, will actually escape. If the potential is like this, it will roll down this side or roll down that side exponentially.
Is that what happens when we have the accelerated expansion and this is positive?
Yeah, that's what it is, exactly. We have inflation when that thing goes negative. And in fact, when that included, right? If you do the Fourier transform, this becomes a k squared. And then all of the, then we have three terms that determine the frequency, right? Namely, the k vector squared. And then we have that term here. We have the term m squared a squared and minus a double prime over a. Yes, and when the acceleration becomes so large that it dominates over that, that's when that happens. And we will see that
let's build the intuition as we go along. Yes.
Does it ever make sense to have an acceleration function that grows in like an oscillatory acceleration function where the universe is expanding and then decaying or contracting?
Yeah, for sure. For example, let's say we had a universe without a cosmological constant. And let's say it is compact, like a sphere, but three sphere, spatially. You can easily consider a situation, easily write down solutions where the universe expands, but more and more slowly, and then it recontracts into a point. That can happen. Also, the history of the universe as we know it has had
you know, the universe stepping on the brakes, stepping on the gas, on the brakes, on the gas, it does all that. And we know why to some extent. We know, for example, that the energy momentum tensor behaves differently, it scales differently when the universe is radiation dominated than when it is matter dominated. And that's essentially because if the universe is matter dominated, if most of the energy is in the form of matter, then matter dilutes. It dilutes with the scale factor to the power 3 in the denominator because it's the volume effect, right? You have the same number of particles spread out over a larger volume because the number of particles doesn't increase, but the volume increases, right? So it scales like 1 over 8 to the third power. The energy density scales like 1 over 8 to the third power just by dilution. But if these particles are not regular matter particles but are radiation, photons, well, the photons dilute. But they also have their wavelengths stretched. And that makes them lose energy as well. So therefore, the energy momentum tensor scales differently depending on whether it's dominated by matter or by radiation. And it could also be motivated, dominated by other things, such as the cosmological constant or the potential of a scalar field. And all these scaling laws translate then into the dynamics of what the scale factor does, whether or not it can recollapse or whether or not it will speed up more or slow down. We will see how all of that happens. Okay, so this is the Klein-Gordon equation that we will deal with. And let's remember that we will have to unpack it later once we have the solution, because once we have everything expressed in terms of chi, we may want to re-express it in terms of phi as well. So we want to prepare for quantization. Remember, we are still firmly on the action Lagrangian side. But for quantization, we want the Hamiltonian. So for that, we need the canonically conjugate field. Now, we are working no longer with the phi field. We don't forget it. But we are really wanting to work with the chi field because it has independent true harmonic oscillators. And in order to quantize them, we need to know what the canonically conjugate field is to chi. And we suspect it's not chi dot. But what is it? Well, let's give it a name. Let's call it pi superscript chi to indicate it's the field canonically conjugate to chi. It may or may not be the canonically conjugate to the phi field too. We'll have to find out. So just to be safe, let's call it pi superscript chi, the canonically conjugate field to chi. And how do we calculate it? Well, we developed the recipe in the previous lectures. We just do the Legendre transform. So we consider the action up here somewhere. We consider the action, and we drop the time integration. That gives us the Lagrangian. And from the Lagrangian, we can now calculate by functional differentiation the Legendre transform. And in particular, we get the canonically conjugate to chi by functionally differentiating the Lagrangian with respect to chi prime, with respect to the time derivative of chi. And what is that? Well, very simple, because it's just the square of the time derivative. Things behave exactly like they did in Minkowski space in that regard. And we find out that the pi, canonically conjugate field to chi, is actually chi prime, as simple as it could possibly be. But just to be sure we're not overlooking something here, let's do this procedure also for the phi. What is the field that is canonically conjugate to phi? Well, let's see. This was the action for phi. I mean, it's the same action, right? Just expressed in terms of phi. Dropping the time integral, we obtain the Lagrangian, and then we can calculate what the canonically conjugate field pi superscript phi is. So we take that integrand here, and we functionally differentiate it with respect to the phi prime, which is to say with respect to phi comma 0. This is diagonal, so we see what we get. We get a phi prime, but it's actually coming with a prefactor a squared. You may wonder, why? What is the a to the minus 2 here? True, but there's also an a to the 4. So overall, it's an a squared times phi prime. All right. So what we see is that the canonically conjugate field to pi is actually a squared phi, a squared phi prime, which is not the same as the canonically conjugate field to chi. And why should it be? It isn't. Well, let's compare. So the canonically conjugate field to chi, this one, is chi prime. And chi is a phi by definition. So chi prime is a phi prime, which gives us two terms. One term where we differentiate the phi and one term where we differentiate the a. So we have two terms. But we know that a squared phi prime is pi phi. So here we have only an a, so we can write it as pi superscript phi, but we have to divide by an a over here. And that term we just carry forward. And so now we see the relationship between the two canonically conjugate momentum fields. The canonically conjugate momentum field to chi is 1 over a times the canonically conjugate momentum field to phi plus a prime phi. Just to say, we need to be careful here. This all needs to be calculated. We cannot assume that things are the same or anything like that. So two different canonically conjugate momenta. But we've made our choice. We want to quantize with respect to the chi. Of course, if we quantize with respect to the phi, we should get the same thing. And we will take care of that. Now, let's do the quantization. In terms of the phi field and its canonically conjugate field, what we have is we require this at all times. And of course, that the phi commutes with itself and the pi phi commutes with itself. And now the claim is, I mean, this is what we would do anyway. But now the claim is that there is no problem with the field redefinition from phi to chi because if we now substitute the phi, for the phi and the pi phi, using these relations, the expression, if we just substitute chi and its canonically conjugate momentum field, then we obtain that chi and its canonically conjugate momentum field obey the same commutation relations. The reason is ultimately that these two guys differ by that term, but this phi commutes with phi. That's ultimately why that drops out. So the proof goes like this. We want to calculate what is the commutator between chi and pi chi. And we sub in what we know chi to be. It's this. And we just calculate what pi chi is. It's those two terms here. And then we find that there's an a and a 1 over a canceling each other. And the phi and the pi, that's this commutator. And then here we have a phi commuting with this phi. So that term doesn't really mess things up. And therefore, well, that commutator is I h bar delta 3x. So we might as well quantize with the chi variable. No problem there. However, we now are facing a slightly weird situation because we started with the action, or the Lagrangian. That's the same thing, really. They just differ by a time integral. We started with the Lagrangian. And then we could, and we did, do a Legendre transform with respect to the phi prime variable. And then got the canonically conjugate momentum to phi. And that gives us then a Hamiltonian, which is given by integral over old variable times new variable expressed in terms of the old variable, old variable expressed in terms of the new variable minus the Lagrangian. We get a Hamiltonian here. But we can also do the Legendre transform with respect to the chi field and its canonically conjugate momentum field, and then write down the Hamiltonian. And there we are. Remember at the beginning of the class today, I promised you many, many Hamiltonians for the same system. And you see,
we have two
Yeah, and this is just two Hamiltonians. But, you know, instead of the scale factor A of t, I could have chosen some other function B of t. Just pull it out of the hat, right? And we could have done the Legendre transform then. And so, yeah, and you get an infinite number of Hamiltonians. However, same theory. Same theory. Now, if it's any consolation, the Lagrangian is unique. It's the Hamiltonians of which you can get a lot. Right? The Lagrangian is derived from the action. The action is a scalar. And because we write everything with covariant derivatives and so on in the action, you can choose whatever you want. And it's the same action. OK, so now how can it be that this Hamiltonian is the generator of time evolution, like this? And that is the generator of time evolution. And yet, they're not the same. How could that be? Well, the answer is that if you look at it in the Heisenberg picture, remember that if you calculate the time derivative of some observable, then there's no dot, it's just this. What is that? That's q hat and h hat, right? Not quite, right? Because, let me put it like this, it's minus I. Not quite, because there's also plus, and then there is a d by dt of q hat, where you're only differentiating with respect to the explicit dependence that q may have. Do you remember that? It's true for the Hamilton equation. It's true for the Heisenberg equation. For example, ordinary quantum mechanics. If you want to calculate what is the time evolution of, let's say, the momentum operator p hat of t, Heisenberg picture, right? Then what do you have? You have p hat dot is equal to, and then you have minus I commutator of p hat, and then the Heisenberg Hamiltonian h hat, like that. But what if I define a new observable q hat of t, which is equal to cosine of 37 constant t, we need that for the units, and then p hat of t plus tangent to the third power of 4 n t, and then we have, let's say, an x hat to the third of t. This thing doesn't obey q hat dot equal to minus I q hat h hat. No, it obeys this plus, and then you have the explicit time dependence of q hat as well, a time dependence that we legislated into it that wasn't generated by the dynamics, but by our choice of what the variable is. And we did such a thing just now. Right? Remember, we did that when we chose to use a new variable. Instead of phi, we're using chi. And chi depends on phi in a time-dependent way, just like that. Right? And therefore, what is in one choice of variables without this, in the other choice of variables, you would need that, and vice versa. So let's see how that plays out. So how can we have that I phi prime time derivative is equal to the commutator of phi with h superscript phi, and at the same time, I times time derivative of chi is the commutator of chi with the Hamiltonian with the superscript chi. And these two Hamiltonians are different. Shouldn't there be one Hamiltonian for all variables? And the answer is yes, there is one variable for all Hamiltonians. And we can, of course, use the h superscript phi for that. See, as I said, in quantum mechanics, you have that if q has in its definition a legislated time dependent, that's nothing to do with nature but with our choice, that shows up over here. And so here, explicitly, what we have is that the chi is a times phi, that was our definition. And we have that the Heisenberg equation of motion holds for phi. And then we can substitute these things in. So what we have is that the phi is chi over A. So we have that this term is this term. And here we have 1 over A times chi, that's phi again, that commutator. And here we have the Hamiltonian with a superscript phi. This generates two terms, namely these two terms. And here we are just carrying forward that commutator. And then we have this term here, and we can multiply with A. We can take the entire equation and multiply it with A. Then that A goes away, 1 over A goes away, and we just have this. See, this is now the left-hand side of that, right? It's I times the time derivative of chi. And then here we have the commutator of chi with the Hamiltonian of phi. That 1 over A went away when we multiplied that entire equation with A. And we have that extra term over here. That's the extra term here. That's arising because the chi is a time-dependent function of the phi. So since we have this equation and we have that equation, we can also read off from that that these two Hamiltonians cannot be the same, because otherwise that term would have to vanish. Okay, so two different Hamiltonians, but it doesn't matter which one we use. We just have to be careful which one we use, because depending on which variable is the primary one, and the primary one is the one for which we are using also its canonically conjugate, we will have that the other variable will then have an artificial time dependence in it, which will show up like this. But it's completely equivalent whether we work with the phi or the chi in principle. Okay, but we have different Hamiltonians. In principle, infinitely many choices. So how to make sense of that? Let's get back to the question that I raised at the very beginning. What is energy? We think of energy as being the Hamiltonian. But the Hamiltonian, well, that's no longer a unique thing here. The moment we allow ourselves diffeomorphism invariance and to redefine time, we can cook up any number of Hamiltonians. And indeed, the energy momentum tensor is calculated differently in pre-Einstein theory and post-Einstein theory. With general relativity, the energy momentum tensor is no longer calculated by using translation invariance in space and time. Maybe that's a derivation you've seen before. And you can derive the energy momentum tensor of a field through the translation invariance in space and time. But we don't have that in general relativity in general, except if we have Killing vector fields. So that doesn't work. And what Einstein and Hilbert discovered is that the energy momentum tensor can be calculated instead as the generator of gravity, as the right-hand side of the Einstein equation. And that's really the energy. See, the role of energy really shifts as you go from the pre-GR physics to the post-GR physics. Before general relativity, for example, the overall scale of the energy never mattered. It never mattered how large an energy actually was. The only thing that matters in non-gravitational physics is energy differences. You can also think of it as forces, the derivative of energies, right? But here, it matters. It matters how big that is. And we still haven't completely resolved the issue because, as you know, quantum fields contribute an infinity here. At least naively, they seem to contribute an infinity here. And then we seem to be back to square one, because then we have to renormalize. It's as if only differences matter, actually. But it definitely seems to tell us that absolute energies do matter for gravity. So let's look at the energy momentum tensor. In general relativity, the energy momentum tensor for a field is calculated this way. It's 2 over square root of g, and then the functional derivative of the action with respect to the metric. I said it's the energy momentum tensor with respect to a field, but it's really for all fields. And what you obtain in the case of the Klein-Gordon field is this contribution. If there are other fields, then of course they will contribute to the action as well, extra terms, and so you get extra contributions to the energy momentum tensor. So that's the expression that you get there. And the T00 component is called the energy density. That's the T00 component if you write it in terms of the field phi and its canonically conjugate momentum field, or in terms of the time derivative of phi, of course. And I leave it to you as an exercise to verify that that's true, that if you take that expression and consider the case of FRWL space-times with the expressions for the metric that we had, conformal time, co-moving coordinates, then the energy momentum tensor has this 0,0 component. That's the energy density. If you have time, try to verify that. Just plug in here the definitions and calculate that. And then from that, you can now compare with the H phi. I didn't actually show you the expression for the Hamiltonian with respect to the field phi, but you can do it. We have the Lagrange, the Legendre transform and the Lagrangian, you can do that. And then what you can show is that this Hamiltonian is actually the integral, the spatial integral over that energy density. It's not what you would get, right, if you had the H chi and integrated that up, because that's a different Hamiltonian. But if you take that Hamiltonian and integrate it up in space, that's the energy. Sorry, yeah, if you take that energy density, integrate it up over space, you get that. And then you may also want to calculate the H chi of eta and find out that it's not the same as that one. It still generates the time evolution, though. It's not the thing that gravitates, though. That's that. Okay? Okay, that's as far as we got today. Any questions?